J.K. Rowling, who's author, of course, of the Harry Potter books, is suing RDR Books over its plans to publish the Harry Potter Lexicon. On the second day of the trial in federal court in New York City, the author of the Lexicon, a longtime fan, broke down in tears. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Testifying before Judge Robert Patterson was Stephen Vander Ark, the former school librarian has devoted many years to creating a Harry Potter website, the Harry Potter Lexicon, and indexing the content of the books online. Choking back tears, he said he had come under a lot of criticism from the fan community, and he regarded Rowling as a genius. He said he had had concerns about whether publishing his encyclopedia would constitute copyright infringement, but was convinced by the publisher to go ahead. On Monday, the first day of the trial, Rowling's lawyer, Dale Sandali, had the British author read alphabetical entries in five different books, books like The Idiot's Guide to Harry Potter and The Magical Worlds of Harry Potter. Arguing in each case, the paragraphs in the Harry Potter lexicon were short and similar to Rowling's own words. The other books had extensive commentary, new and often scholarly material, and were therefore more properly a case of fair use. Rowling called Vander Ark's lexicon sloppy and a ripoff. The lawyer for RDR Books said the lawsuit was an attempt by Rowling to stamp out competition to the encyclopedia she is writing. Rowling said she liked Vander Ark's website and even gave it an award, but on the stand she implied that a free fan website was one matter, a book costing $24.99 that was mostly her own words was another. A spokesman for J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers released a statement saying that a fan's affectionate enthusiasm should not obscure acts of plagiarism. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
As nervous as you may be about the trouble in the U.S. economy, Kevin Phillips thinks you may not be nervous enough. Phillips is a former Republican strategist and former commentator on this program. In more recent years, he has sounded serious warnings about his country's politics, its economy, and its future. In a new book called Bad Money, Phillips argues there is a reason the credit crisis spreads through the whole economy. He says it's because the credit industry almost is the economy. How has Wall Street steered us as a country toward greater and greater debt of many different kinds?
You've had a massive upheaval in the United States in the last two decades in which financial services, the financial sector includes finance, insurance, and real estate, has dwarfed manufacturing, which has slipped way down and become the leading part of the economy in terms of share of gross domestic product. This sector ballooned. It increased hugely in size. One of its biggest products is actually debt and credit, credit cards and debt obligations.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, because you're saying that this is an economy where we used to make steel, we used to make cars, we used to make television sets, any number of other things, and now you're arguing that the basic thing that we make the greatest share of money on is debt products and other financial services.
You've got an economy that runs basically on money being moved around. And we now have convenience fees on ATMs, all kinds of things like this. It doesn't make much anymore in terms of products. And as a result, we have to import huge amounts of manufactured goods and oil. And it costs just buckets and buckets of money. And we can't afford that. So we're an international debtor, too. It creates a special vulnerability. We have taken this sector, which is speculative, unstable, given to all kinds of practices that haven't been regulated much for the last 20 years, and put it in charge of the U.S. economy. That is not a smart idea.
What is it that makes you say that this period that you see in the United States, where financial services are becoming more and more important as an economic engine, what is it that makes you say that that has been, in effect, a terminal stage or the late stage of other great nations and empires?
Well, if you look back at the leading world economic powers, the Dutch and then the British stopped doing what they were doing so well for so long, industry, maritime commerce. And in their last decades, they became more and more dependent on finance, on providing services to the world, banking, maritime insurance, all of these sorts of things. And they thought that would work, that that was a new form of success, and that was the next stage of a great economy. It wasn't. It was a stage in which they were starting to lose what had been built up by the solid things, industry and physical commerce and agriculture and maritime industries. If we look at what happened to them, it's confirming the dangers of letting yourself get into this posture of thinking that you can provide services and finance to the world and that works. It never has.
Well, is there a reason that you choose to include this quote in your book, which goes even further back in history, for an analogy? If we are Rome, Wall Street's our Colosseum.
I thought that was a very good observation by a commentator on Market Watch. He used that slogan, and I think it's true in the sense that it's a global arena, Colosseum or not, but finance is where these things are being fought out. It's where we're losing these battles. The dollar is like a gladiator bleeding on the field of the Colosseum. Things that we used to produce that we don't produce anymore are just shooting up in their cost to us. We're importing inflation as the price of oil rises because people buy it as a substitute for investing in the dollar. The Colosseum is telling us huge trouble, but the Colosseum doesn't make it onto the evening news. The Colosseum just becomes little things about the Dow Jones Industrial Average and it was a bad day on the market and no sense that this is a nation's fate being adjudicated.
When you try to take the longer view, do you think it's already too late?
Well, it's not too late in one very important sense. These countries that have had these problems historically have gone through periods of 20, 30, 40 years when adjusting to their new lesser role has caused lots of problems. They've had to make major adjustments. They couldn't live nearly so high on the hog. The British even had food rationing for almost 10 years after World War II. But when you make the adjustments and you come out, you're strong again. And obviously Britain is prosperous now. So for the United States, the important thing is to think about the next stage after we go through the crisis and we build a better foundation and we stop thinking that we can be the policeman of the world, the banker of the world, the great advice giver of the world, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't work. But there is a future for the United States, as there has been for all these others, when things change and the new framework is built.
Now, wait a minute. There was what was famously called the American century, a century dominated by the United States. Are you saying there's not going to be another, but we can at least hope for a pretty decent place in the Chinese century or whatever it's going to be?
Well, I would say that this century we're in now is not going to be the American century. If it was going to be the American century, we wouldn't be going hat in hand to the investment funds of Singapore, of Saudi Arabia, of China. Power is shifting to Asia. Wealth is shifting to Asia. Power is shifting away from the United States. We're fighting bad wars in bad places, and Asia's putting together the fulcrum of industry and finance and just about everything for, let's say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years out.
Kevin Phillips is a former Republican strategist, now the author of many books, the latest of which is called Bad Money. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Eric Cash is the main character of Lush Life, the new novel by author Richard Price. But I don't know if you would necessarily call him the book's hero. Eric is the manager of a restaurant on Manhattan's Lower East Side after being a failed actor and a failed writer and at the age where he's about to be a failed hipster in a gentrified part of the city where hipness is almost more important than breathing. Eric finds himself tangled in the murder investigation of his restaurant's new bartender. At one point, he's even a suspect. Lush Life is set in a part of Manhattan that is in a real state of change where crumbling buildings are next to sleek new hotels and old housing projects, all sharing a tightly confined space. The events that set off Eric Cash's personal spiral bring together an equally broad range of characters, aging Chinese men living dozens to a single apartment, Yemeni brothers who run a local convenience store, wealthy landlords, young stick-up artists, and what seems like dozens of police officers. Richard Price, yes, Richard Price, author of Clockers, Freedom Land, and Samaritan, wrote the book Lush Life, and he's in our studio. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Fans have been waiting 5 years for a new novel from you. Were you working on this particular novel, or were all these other projects that you had going on, The Wire, etc., taking your attention away from sitting down to write a book?
Well, The other projects were kind of excuses not to write, since I don't particularly like to write. But in this time, I was hanging out on the Lower East Side, which is what I usually do to prepare for a book. Just try to soak things up by osmosis. At some point in the hanging out process, I started taking notes. At some point, the notes had punctuation. I started hanging out a little less, writing a little more punctuation. But, you know, it was a gradual coming together of a book over about 3 years.
So it wasn't a case of, you knew, I need to sit down right now. I've got this idea for a 455-page novel in my head, and I have to get it out.
No, the novels always feel like I fell down a flight of stairs with a bunch of paper and a pen, and by the time I hit the landing, I wrote something.
And I'm not going to let it go that you just said, I don't really like to write. How does that work out?
I mean, I think, I feel like writing is, of all the different art forms, writing is the most antsy, because all you do is sit there and rearrange the letters of the alphabet. You know, a painter can, there's a physical component, there's hand-eye coordination, there's standing on your feet, literally, you know, being acting, directing. I don't like writing. I don't know if I have ADD, but I think it might have given it to me. So I'd much rather hang out with the people I'm writing about. And a lot of that is legitimate, and some of that is avoiding work.
So you really have to be disciplined to create a novel for you.
Yeah, I mean, at some point I've got to buckle under, but it's kind of like jogging. People who hate to jog, you spend 4 hours puttering around to avoid jogging for 20 minutes.
One of the things I really like about the book is there's these two layers going on in Lush Life. There's the murder mystery, the plot, and then this neighborhood as an analogy for all the different characters we meet. I'm going to ask you to read page 40, because I think both are in play on page 40.
Okay. The person whose point of view this scene is, his name is Matty Clark, and he's the detective that's in charge of this robbery turned homicide. And he's just coming on the scene, and it's about 4:15 in the morning. Matty continued to scan the streets for security cameras. Didn't think he'd find any. Eyed the tenement windows, wondering how much of a canvas, if any, he could manage before the squad came in at 8. Despite the limbo hour, the block was alive with an intersection of two parties. The last of the young kids still on their way home from the lounges and music bars, just like the homicide and his friends. And the pre-land rush old-timers. The Chinese, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, and Bangladeshi, just starting their day, either leaning out those weathered stone windowsills or going off to work. Many of the homebound kids lingered behind the crime scene tape, but the scene barely seemed to register on the ethnics, especially the undocumenteds, heading off for the market terminals, restaurants, and sweatshops around town. The sky continued to almost imperceptibly lighten, the birds coming on in earnest now, dozens of them barreling low from tree to tree over the crime scene, as if they were stringing beads.
When you've got the procedural part of this, the detective on the scene, checking out what's going on around, looking around, when you're going through and you're writing a crime novel, did the setting come first or did the plot come first in this particular case?
Okay, well, first of all, I don't consider this a crime novel. It's a novel with a crime in it, you know, just like American Tragedy mm-hmm. was a novel with a crime in it. With this book, what came first was the Lower East Side. I just wanted to write about the Lower East Side. I was down there, and I was racking my brains for a way to get in. There was about six different subcultures down there. It's chaos. And I couldn't figure out how to write about this place without it sounding like a travelogue. And then I realized, which is something I've done before, that when you have a very Byzantine landscape, a crime, if you follow the progression of an investigation, it's sort of a lazy man's way to a plot. You just follow the orderliness of an investigation because everything you do is related to that, and it makes everything relative, and it comes in at a natural point while you're following these guys trying to figure out who did it and why they did it.
What part of the Lower East Side helped you develop characters? Eric, at one point when the detectives are questioning him about this stick-up mugging, whether it is or not, and they talk about he and this other guy harassing a local guy who had a Virgin Mary who had appeared on the wall. And I thought, wow, that's very clever, because you get to know more about Eric and this guy by the way they interacted with the locals. Are there other examples where the city, this area, the Lower East Side, really helps inform us, the reader, about the characters?
Basically, what I try to do is show people occupying the same physical space but being oblivious to each other. They're not even ships passing in the night. They're rowboats passing in the night. People don't see anybody but their own kind.
Are there things in the novel, are there episodes in the novel which are things you saw directly off the street from times when you were just hanging out in the Lower East Side?
There probably is, but, you know, the danger is just because it happens, it doesn't make it art. The trick is to see something, then think, is this relevant or is this just cool? You know, if it's just cool, forget it. One of the things that didn't make it is I saw a car stop, a bike stop, actually. These two guys are in this roving quality of life squad. See a black guy riding a bicycle with a 9-year-old white kid on the crossbars at midnight. And they call a stop to it. It just doesn't look right to them. And they basically separate the kid and the guy. And basically the kid has a nervous breakdown because the cops are kind of trying to provoke him to tell them anything, and the kid gets it. They don't like the fact that this guy is black and the kid's white. I saw something like that. I wrote it, and it just didn't make the cut. Not because it wasn't good writing or wasn't an important encounter, because it just didn't fit into the flow. It would have been like trying to stuff something into a bag that would therefore not be able to go into the overhead rack.
I also really like the title of the book, Lush Life. How do the various definitions of lush play into this novel?
Well, I only had one notion. I knew the Billy Strayhorn song title, but I never looked at the lyrics. And for me, I meant lush as in abundance. I mean, because you had the Hispanics, the Chinese, the black, the new wave middle-class white kids, the Orthodox Jews, the cops. I mean, you had a riot of cultures down there. So, and also I like the irony of the fact that the book centers around a death. So I thought Lush Life would be, you know, pretty good. Then after I gave it to the printer, I finally looked at the lyrics and realized it was about a bunch of old ladies getting hammered at a bar on 3rd Avenue in the middle of the day. So I kind of blew it on that end, but...
You have one of my favorite verbs to describe hammered is zotzed. I never heard that before.
I like boxed.
you've read this in every review. I'm not breaking news here that dialogue is really a hallmark of your work, and you're
I don't think I'm ever going to write dialogue again.
Well, do you hear it in your head, or do you know the characters' voices?
I know the characters' voices because by the time I'm writing dialogue for them, you know, I've committed them to paper in some ways. So, but the way I do it is basically I do, you know, I sit down and I just improv. I do it with it's like scat singing, mm-hmm. You know, coherent scat singing. It's like I know where I want the conversation to end, and I know where it begins, and the whole middle is an improv. You know, and I just sort of trust myself to, like, you know, riff it out.
You wrote your first novel when you were 24, right?
Well, I published it when I was 24, so I wrote it when I was like 12 or 11 or something.
Have you ever taken out The Wanderers and read it again recently?
I can't.
You can't? Why not?
I look back at my old stuff, all I can see is what I got away with.
I've never read that book. If I read that book after I finish reading Lush Life, will I recognize the writing style of Richard Price?
I don't know. That's people who have done that, read it after Lush Life, they said, yep, it's you. You know, but it's sort of like seeing a picture of yourself as a teenager when you're middle-aged and being shocked that you recognize yourself.
Before I let you go, you're on book tour, which can be grueling and great and obnoxious and horrible. What are people asking you during your book tour?
Well, I think the most common question that comes up, and I'm grateful that it hasn't been asked here, is the difference between screenwriting and writing a novel. I mean, the problem with a book, and, you know, like, you do a book tour, and, you, okay, so I did 18 cities. The problem is you look at a book, and there's just so many questions to ask, and they're all kind of obvious. And so you will hear the same questions over and over again. If I didn't write that book and I was an interviewer, I'd probably ask the same questions. You know, the trick is to come up with new answers that aren't lies so you don't lose your mind.
You haven't lied to me today, have you?
Sure, I haven't.
Richard Price, the name of the book is Lush Life. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.